Genealogy by Tim, Season 2, Episode 9, recorded September 26, 2022. Joseph Martin Boland is one of the Graham family tree's most famous inhabitants. He was best known as the voice of Notre Dame football on WSBT Sports Radio in South Bend, Indiana. Before that, he coached football for several universities, and before that, he was a college football star himself, one of the seven mules that cleared the way for Knute Rockne's Four Horsemen to win the Rose Bowl championship in 1925. He was also my great-grandfather's cousin. We're spending the episode this month on the Notre Dame man, Joe Boland. We'll review his history, his career, and even get to hear his voice, all coming your way on Genealogy by Tim. So a few months ago, I began a genealogy side project in which I would go through each of my ancestors one by one and prepare their media galleries on my local computer's family tree so that they would be properly formatted when exported to my website. The trouble with this project is that it's so easy to get sidetracked. I've only just completed galleries of ancestors' surnames beginning with A and B, and I've already gone down five or six rabbit holes. When I got to the Boland family, I just thought, I have to do a good job on the Bolands, especially Joe. Before my grandfather, Joseph A. Graham, died 6 years ago, I used to spend Saturday evenings talking family history with him. Joe Boland was always one of his favorite relatives. Pop-Pop always glowed when he spoke of the Four Horsemen and the Seven Mules. So I bought a copy of Joe Boland's biography, which was compiled by his widow, Peg, within 2 years of his sudden and untimely death in 1960. I was never much of a book reader myself, so I loaned the book to my grandfather, and he enjoyed reading it. That was back in 2015 or 2016. Fast forward to the present day. When I came across the Boland family during the course of my gallery reorganization project, I thought, now is the time to read this book. It's probably the first book I've read since I was in law school in the 20-aughts, and it's been my primary resource in piecing together Joe Boland's life story. Let's start with the family connection. The patriarch of the Boland family in America was Michael Boland, who married Bridget Graham, the sister of my great-great-grandfather, John Charles Graham, in 1895, after they each came to America from Ireland. The Grahams were from Onahoy, County Antrim. Michael Boland was from Milltown Malbay, County Clare. Census records indicate that Bridget arrived in America around the year 1885 or 86, and Michael arrived in around 1890. Michael first worked as a laborer, then a bartender, and later as a saloon keeper. The couple had six children, many of whom became prominent, successful members of their communities. The eldest, John P. Boland, was born in 1896. He was an assistant district attorney, and then register of wills, and then orphans court judge in the city of Philadelphia. In fact, when you go into the office of the Register of Wills in Philadelphia City Hall to do your genealogy research, the administration books up on the shelves between the years 1941 and 1949 all bear the name Boland on each spine. It's almost as if my relatives are watching over me as I research. After John came Reverend James A. Boland, who was born in 1898 and grew up to be a priest, then pastor of the Holy Martyrs Roman Catholic Church in Orland, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. After Charles came Edward, born in 1900, who was a postal clerk at Philadelphia's Central Post Office, then at 30th and Market Streets. After Edward came the man of the hour, Joseph Martin Boland, who was born on September 7th, 1904. Joseph's birth certificate is on file at the Philadelphia City Archives at 6th and Spring Garden Streets, but if you want to go see it, you'll have to request it under the name Joseph Boland. The name was written in cursive, which made it hard enough to read. If that weren't bad enough, some helper at the office actually wrote Borland, B-O-R-L-A-N-D, in block letters over the cursive surname, ensuring that genealogists for years to come would have a dickens of a time trying to find the document. Joe's wasn't the only birth certificate that was bungled. You'd think a name like Boland would be pretty straightforward, but Edward's surname was misspelled Bolin, B-O-L-I-N. And James's surname was misspelled Bohan, B-O-H-A-N. It makes me wonder what the name sounds like when it's spoken with an Irish brogue. I wasn't there for the births, but I would guess that's probably how the name ended up the way it did on the birth documents. After Joe came Francis, born in 1907, who grew up to be a physician. And lastly came Michael, who was born in 1909. He grew up to earn an MS in education from the University of Pennsylvania and was registrar of St. Joseph's College in Philadelphia for about a quarter century. Just as the flame that burns twice as bright lasts half as long, only one of these Boland brothers lived past the age of 70. John P. Boland, the judge and register of wills, died in 1952 at the age of 56 after complications from surgery to cure hypertension. Edward Boland, the postal clerk, died in 1964 at the age of 63 after suffering from heart disease. Francis Boland, the physician, died in 1971 at the age of 64, and I won't know the cause of his death until Ancestry.com releases his death certificate, which should happen sometime in the coming months. Michael, the registrar at St. Joe's College, died tragically in 1966 at the age of 57. His obituaries do not mention his cause of death. His death certificate lists the manner of death as undetermined, while also mentioning asphyxiation and a rope around the neck. Joe Boland himself was the first of these brothers to leave this world. He died of a heart attack in 1960 at the age of 55. The Reverend James A. Boland lived the longest. He died in 1980 at the age of 82. All of these Bolands, except for Joe, are buried in Holy Sepulchre Cemetery in Cheltenham, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia. Their gravestone monument is two plots to the right of my grandparents' gravestone monument in Section T. So when I go out there to remember my grandparents, the Bolands are right there, just a part of our family. Joe Boland, Notre Dame man, is buried in Cedar Grove Cemetery, which is run by the university. Joe was mentioned in a Burials of Interest memorial video that is posted on that cemetery's website. The Boland boys all attended Roman Catholic High School, an all-boys high school located on Broad Street in Philadelphia. Joe Boland was on the football team, and it was his coach, Stan Kofall, who noticed Joe's talents and drove him and two of his classmates, Joe Maxwell and Vince McNally, to New York to meet Knute Rockne, who was then head coach of Notre Dame's football team. Knute was an early innovator of the sport. In the 1940 film Knute Rockne All-American, it explains that Knute basically invented the forward pass while playing football for Notre Dame in 1913. Notre Dame's father, Pete McCormick, investigated this claim and found that to be an exaggeration. While Knute didn't himself invent the forward pass, he did perfect it by being the first to catch passes in stride without stopping or turning. This opened up a world of new and innovative offensive patterns for the time. So when Joe Boland and his classmates met Knute at New York in the summer of 1923, they met one of the early giants of the game and jumped on the opportunity to play for him at Notre Dame in the fall after they graduated from Roman Catholic. Notre Dame's 1924-1925 season is among the most storied in football history. This was the year of the so-called Four Horsemen, who drove Notre Dame to a 27-10 Rose Bowl victory over Stanford. The film Canute Rockne, All-American, portrays the horsemen Harry Stooldreyer, Don Miller, Jim Crowley, and Elmer Layden executing plays inspired by chorus line dance moves to catch their opponents off guard. Joe Boland, a big man weighing at 216 pounds, played left tackle as one of the so-called seven mules who cleared the path for victory ahead of the horsemen. Joe continued to play for Notre Dame and was well on his way to making the College Football All-America team when he suffered a career-ending injury on October 9, 1926, in a game against the University of Minnesota. It was actually Joe's high school friend and classmate, Joe Maxwell, who dealt the blow that ended Joe Boland's football career. The two both moved in together in an attempt to block a kick and accidentally collided. Maxwell expressed regret over the incident in Boland's biography, but found consolation when Joe met and later married his future wife, Margaret Lindbergh, at St. Mary's Hospital in Minneapolis, where Joe recovered from his injury. Margaret, better known as Peg, was born in North Dakota and lived in Bowbells and Fargo as a youth. She was known for being among the 1927 graduating class of Minnesota, which was the first graduating class in which women received degrees in journalism. Peg was among nine women who received the degree that year. The sports editor of the Minnesota Daily asked Peg to do a feature on the injured player for the newspaper. She did, and the rest, as they say, is history. Joseph Boland and Peg Lindbergh were married in Notre Dame's Log Chapel on April 7, 1931. It was a bittersweet event because Joe's former coach, inspiration, and mentor, Canute Rockne, was killed in a plane crash a week earlier on March 31st. His funeral was held in the same log chapel on April 4th, 3 days before Joe and Peg's wedding. Joe and Peg would go on to have two children, Joseph Jr., who was born in 1936, and Meg, who was born in 1940. After Joe's football career had ended, and after he had graduated from Notre Dame, Joe took up coaching, first as a line coach at Santa Clara College in California for the 1928-1929 season, and then as a head football and track coach for the College of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota from 1929 to 1933. The Depression hit hard, but Joe declined to take a pay cut at the time. He left his job as head coach. And while he was between jobs, he got into radio as a sports announcer at WCCO in Minneapolis for a brief stint, foreshadowing his future life's work. Joe Boland returned to coaching back at Notre Dame for the 1934 season. He was offered a position as a line coach under his former teammate, the horseman Elmer Layden, who was then head coach. So thrilled was Joe to be back at his alma mater that he took the job, even though it paid less than what he would have earned at the College of St. Thomas had he not left. Joe remained at this position as a line coach until 1941, and he coached his last season, the 1941-1942 season, at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Joe's interest shifted at this point. He earned a Master of Education degree from Notre Dame in 1942, but was enticed back into broadcasting. His first gig as a broadcaster was in Chicago for WGN Radio in 1943. From there, he found his way back home once again to South Bend, Indiana, just outside of Notre Dame, for WSBT, the South Bend Tribune's radio station. Here, around 1947, the seeds were planted for what would later be known as the Irish Football Network. It began as an informal association of about a dozen stations that would carry Joe's broadcast of Notre Dame football games. In 1951, Joe formalized the network, having cables laid and arranging the revenue stream that would expand the network to some 49 stations by the end of the 1951-1952 football season, and to 190 stations by 1955. The Irish Football Network went worldwide when Armed Forces Radio picked up Joe's broadcasts for the enjoyment of troops serving overseas. In 1956, the university sold Notre Dame football's broadcasting rights to the Mutual Broadcasting System. Mutual outbid Joe for the rights, but retained him as a sports announcer. By 1958, Joe Boland expanded his media presence to television. His first foray into television that I'm aware of was as the host of a short-lived NBC television program called Ask Me Another in 1952. Fandom.com describes the show this way. Four panelists tried to guess the identity of famous sports personalities. Each guest stood behind a shadow curtain while the panel asked questions to determine who they were. A special feature of the show was the appearance of one guest who would perform his specialty from behind the shadow curtain while being asked questions. The show was produced in Chicago. By 1958, Joe was the director of sports and special events at WSBT-TV in South Bend. Julius Tucker of Business Systems in South Bend, Indiana, recalls that Joe had a show that aired from 5:45 to 6 o'clock p.m. on television, and then a radio show that aired from 6 o'clock to 6:15 p.m. Although the actual name of the program is not known to me, at least part of the program entailed interviews of notable sports personalities. Toward the end of his career, Joe Boland served as president of the Indiana Sports Writers and Broadcasters Association, and also as the voice of the NFL's Chicago Cardinals team for its 1958 and 1959 seasons, their last in that city. The Cardinals would later move around to St. Louis and then to Phoenix, and the team is currently known as the Arizona Cardinals. Joe Boland died suddenly of a heart attack on the 25th of February, 1960. After his death, his widow, Peg Boland, compiled testimonies of Joe's colleagues, associates, and admirers in a biography entitled Joe Boland, Notre Dame Man. The overall tone of the book conveys two qualities of Joe Boland's broadcasts. First, he prioritized accuracy, whereas some of his contemporaries may have prioritized listenability or entertainment value over accuracy, Joe always put accuracy first in all of his broadcasts. Second, Joe was known to accentuate the positives. He never used his microphone to insult or embarrass any team of players. He told it like it was, but didn't dwell on errors, preferring instead to focus on the achievements. In his spare time, it is mentioned, Joe enjoyed bird hunting and golf, although it is admitted that he was not very good at either of these pursuits. And Joe was also open to lending his broadcasting talents to other endeavors where appropriate. He played football coach Hank Hudson in Natalie White's 1955 stage production Billion Dollar Saint, a farce in three acts. And he also narrated Indiana's first live open circuit telecast of a surgical operation on Tuesday, September 9th, 1958 for WSBT-TV. Joe described it as a doubleheader when a woman's gallbladder and appendix were both removed. Joe Boland's widow, Peg Boland, had at least two other book titles to her credit in addition to numerous magazine articles. Valiant Woman, a book of 15 women's compiled essays on their lives as they overcame stress and tragedy, was published in 1956, and Don't Panic, Mother, a memoir of Peg's youth in North Dakota among her many siblings, cats, roosters, dogs, and snakes, was published in 1964. These are in addition to Joe Boland, Notre Dame Man, which Peg compiled and published in 1962. Peg joined Joe in death in 1966, shortly after the publication of Don't Panic, Mother. She was the victim of another heart attack, and they are buried together at Cedar Grove Cemetery in Notre Dame. Joseph Martin Boland was a popular radio and television personality, very little of his recorded work has surfaced online. I searched in vain for clips of his Ask Me Another television program from 1952. I'm sure a lot of his work is out there, waiting in dusty storage rooms to be uncovered. For now, I have the honor of sharing only two audio clips with you. The first one that I'll share is a 30-second clip of Joe Boland announcing a Notre Dame vs. Southern Cal football game in 1954. Here's Joe.
Southern Cal leads 7-0. The Trojans on defense. Carey at quarterback for Notre Dame, 2nd and 10 on the 31. Hands off to Heath. He's through the middle of the 40, the 45, the 50, the 40. He's to the Southern Cal 30-yard line before he's tackled and downed on the play by Merck of Southern California. It's on the 29-yard line as Heath breaks over the middle, actually just over Southern California's left tackle.
That clip was published in 2004 on the audio CD that accompanied Ted Patterson's book, Golden Voices of Football, which also included stories and high-quality photos of Joe's career. That full clip lasted about a minute. To hear the rest of it, among many others of period sports announcers, I urge you to pick up a copy of Golden Voices of Football from your favorite bookstore. The next clip is a good long one. It is a part of archive.org's Joe Henn Memorial Collection. Joe Henn was a collector of old-time radio recordings, which he recorded from the radio onto reel-to-reel tapes. He happened to record one of Joe Boland's interview programs, likely later in the 1950s. The recording was unearthed in the wake of Henn's passing in 2020. Painstakingly restored and posted to archive.org through the heroic efforts of the Old Time Radio Researchers Group at otrr.org. The group accepts donations at its website, so do them a solid and head on over. The link is in the show notes. Without further ado, here is Joe Boland interviewing Terry Brennan while the latter was head coach of Notre Dame's football team sometime between 1954 and 1958. Here's Joe and Terry.
Yes, Fighting Irish football from South Bend, Indiana, home of the University of Notre Dame. This is Joe Boland. In a moment, I'll be talking to head coach Terry Brennan of the Fighting Irish and bringing you predictions on the big football games across the nation. But first, our announcer has a message for you. And our first guest on this series is the most talked about coach in football today, Terry Brennan, who receives his baptism of collegiate coaching fire this coming Saturday from the powerful University of Texas Longhorns. Terry, it's good to see you and to welcome you to Fighting Irish Football.
Thank you, Joe. It's good to be here with you.
Now, we'll talk about Texas and your immediate problems a bit later. Right now, I feel our listeners would like to know a bit more about you. Your home was Milwaukee. You live now here in South Bend. Of course, you're 26, father of two children, a boy and a girl, aged Terry, age 2, and Denise, aged 8 months. You're a graduate of Notre Dame in 1949, graduate of DePaul University in law in 1953, and now head football coach at Notre Dame. Had you planned to become a football coach back in 1949?
Well, I planned, Joe, to go to law school and coach along with it, and at that time, I didn't know whether I wanted to be a lawyer or do some coaching, and as I coached for 2 or 3 years, I began to like it very much, and I was fortunate to have some success with it, and I just enjoyed working with the boys and enjoyed coaching so much that I thought that's what I would like to do. And that decision came, it took about 2 or 3 years in coming, but I'm very happy with coaching, and I hope I can stay with it for some time.
I was just about to ask you, you say it was 2 or 3 years in coming. When did you first begin to think seriously of coaching as a career about your...
Well, I had one semester left in law school, and I had the opportunity to come back here to Notre Dame, and the decision had to be made at that time. If I came down here, it had to be coaching. If I stayed in Chicago or went to Milwaukee, it would have been law, and I felt that I wanted to go into coaching.
Well, the swift developments of last February 1st made you then the successor to Frank Leahy in football here at Notre Dame. What was your first problem in the job?
Well, the first problem was an organization problem of getting a staff together and after selecting them and getting them here. And once we had that, having a series of meetings to plan spring practice and go over our personnel.
Just why did you select the assistant coaches you have working with you now? That is, what recommended these gentlemen to you?
Well, the it's two fellows who stayed from Frank Leahy's staff, Bill Early and Johnny Drews. John had been coaching for 13 years with Frank Leahy, had done a great deal of scouting, very sound fundamentally all the way, and works well with the boys. I just thought he would be a natural to help with that line. Bill Early, the same, hadn't been coaching quite as long as John, but a wealth of experience, did a great job in setting up defenses and handling the backs, and I thought he would be a natural choice. George Dixon had worked at three or four different places, and at each one they spoke very highly of him and hated to see him go. He worked well with the quarterbacks, and although he didn't play a great deal, he was a fine student of the game, and I thought he'd be a good man for that spot, helping with the quarterbacks. Bill Fisher, the other varsity staff member, an All-American here, captain, played four or five years of professional football. He had a wealth of playing experience and know-how to bring with him, plus a good knowledge of people and how to work with them and get something out of them. So I thought that he would be an ideal choice to help with that line.
I think it's an ideal staff, too, well-balanced. Now, let's get down to more immediate matters. The first game with Texas is almost here. Are you satisfied with the practice progress you've made through September?
Well, no, Joe. I guess every coach is the same. You're not satisfied, but the last scrimmage we've had, I wasn't pleased with the way the some of the boys, one or two key men, are not yet in the condition that I think they'll have to be in to play top-notch football. We still have the gaping hole at fullback and right half that isn't solved. Our depth problem is far from answered, although it's improved. I'm still a little bit worried. I would like to have just a little more hard work under our belt before we meet a team like Texas.
Will you tell our listeners of any switches in personnel you've made to date from last year's group?
Well, Walt Cabrell has moved in from end to tackle, and Ray Lemick, who normally plays at guard, is playing offensive tackle and going back to his usual linebacking spot on defense. Don Schaefer, who was right half at the end of the season last year, has moved over to fullback, and Paul Reynolds, of course, I started out in the spring trying Paul at fullback, but his knee did not hold up, so I felt if he played at right half, he wouldn't have the strain on it, so he's still at right halfback.
What about Texas? What do you know of the Longhorns or about them?
Well, we had a couple of fellas scout them the last game of last season, and another person scouted them in their spring game. What I know about them is that they have eight men from the starting lineup back and nine men on the second ball club. So they have a pretty solid first unit and another team to give them depth. They're rated the finest in the Southwest and probably the finest Texas has had in a good many years. And Notre Dame upset them 2 years ago, so they're going to be up here with blood in their eyes. We'll probably have as tough a game as we've had in a long, long time, Joe.
Do you feel there's an advantage in having the game here at Notre Dame? From your point of view, I'm speaking of now.
Well, I think at any time you play at home, it's an advantage. Thing that I'm worried about is if we have a real hot day, it'll be to their advantage because we've had so much cold weather here. The players have not had a chance. They've been working very hard. No one has been loafing out there. They've worked hard to get in the best of condition, but without that good hot weather, they just can't do it. They can't lose that necessary weight.
What will be your probable starting lineup against Texas Saturday?
Well, probable would be Szymanski at center, Palumbo and Jackie Lee at guards, Vericchione and Lemick at tackles. Shannon and Matz are capish, one of the two out of the three in there at end. Guillaume at quarterback, Joe Heap at left, and either Gaffney or Raish at fullback or Sipes or Studer at right half.
Well, Terry, a major responsibility is theirs, this starting lineup against Texas you have just named, representing Notre Dame and your first collegiate coaching effort, Terry Brennan. Good luck to you and those starters as the nation's eyes are on you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, Terry Brennan. Now, there are a lot of big football games coming up, and after our announcer brings you his message, I'll be back with my football prophecy for this week. The prophecy business is as risky as skating on thin ice, but let's take a chance and a quick run around the country at these calls. First, in the East, where it's Penn over Duke, Holy Cross to win from Dartmouth, Cornell to conquer Colgate, and Columbia over Brown. Army, a powerful contender for Eastern and possibly national honors, should defeat South Carolina. Navy win from William & Mary, Yale down Connecticut. It's Princeton to win from Rutgers, Amherst over Colby, Bucknell in the night game to defeat Muhlenberg, Boston University over Brandeis. Delaware's the choice over Westchester, Villanova to win from Syracuse, and Lafayette to down Albright. In the Southeast, Mississippi in a tough one over Kentucky in a night game, Alabama to win from Louisiana State also at night. Tennessee's the team to win from Mississippi State, Georgia Tech to defeat Florida, Baylor to vanquish Vanderbilt. Georgia gets the nod over Clemson, North Carolina over North Carolina State, and Auburn to win from Chattanooga. Tulane to trim Memphis State, George Washington over VMI, and Wake Forest to defeat VPI, and Virginia to win from Lehigh. The Southwest has Texas at Notre Dame, Baylor at Vanderbilt, Southern Methodist, and Rice without opposition, so the schedule is light but good. Oklahoma Sooners will trim Texas Christian, Tulsa win from Arkansas, and the Texas Aggies down Oklahoma's Aggies in a night game. Other night contests will see Texas Tech the victor over West Texas State, while Hardin-Simmons will defeat New Mexico's Aggies. The Pacific Coast and Rocky Mountain regions have a wingding of a game Friday night, Southern California and Pittsburgh at Los Angeles. Now, don't sell Pittsburgh short here, but in a close one, USC. Oregon to defeat Stanford, California in a romp over San Jose State, UCLA to conquer Kansas, Washington State to take tough College of the Pacific, Utah over Arizona, Oregon State over Idaho, Utah State to win from Wichita, Wyoming to whip Kansas State. Nevada should triumph over San Francisco State, New Mexico over San Diego State in a night game. Colorado over the Colorado Aggies and Colorado College to take Idaho State. Now, the Midwest jumps into tough conference competition right off the bat, with Michigan State Spartans operating under a new head coach, Hugh Duffy Doherty, at Iowa. We like the Spartans of State, and Indiana in an upset of form over Ohio State. Illinois to whip Penn State, Michigan to win from Washington at Seattle, Northwestern to take Iowa State, and Wisconsin to win from state rival Marquette. Minnesota, operating under a new head football coach, Murray Warmath, is the choice over Nebraska, Boston College in a night game over rugged Detroit, Toledo to win from Western Reserve, Cincinnati to have a handful with Dayton, but Cincinnati to win, Xavier over Ohio University, Butler to beat Evansville. And in the big one, we'll describe over the Irish Football Network, Texas is favored, and properly so, over the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame. But depending strictly on traditional Irish fight and the fact that this game is to be played at Notre Dame, Notre Dame to win in a tough one. Now, those are our predictions for this week. I'll be back in a moment with a few words about next week's show. Next week, I'll have Notre Dame co-captains Dan Shannon and Paul Matz as my guests, and we'll have more predictions for you, of course. Now, this is Joe Boland saying goodbye from South Bend, Indiana, home of the University of Notre Dame and Fighting Irish Football. Remember to join us on this station for the Irish Football Network's play-by-play broadcast of the Texas at Notre Dame game Saturday.
So that was Joe Boland in his interview persona. I'm aware of only one other obtainable recording of Joe Boland's work. Doak Ewing at RareSportsFilms.com is offering for sale through his website some DVDs that include footage from the Chicago Cardinals' 1958 and 1959 seasons. Joe Boland announced for the team those seasons. So, to immerse yourself in Joe Boland's soothing baritone voice, do check out RareSportsFilms.com and order your copy of those videos. And that's it for the program. I hope you enjoyed this month's Spotlight on Joseph M. Boland, Notre Dame man. Next month on the podcast, my Big Y 700 DNA analysis ought to be ready. I'm sure I'll have a bit to say about that. And if I discover any new and interesting loose ends in the process of reformatting my media galleries, I'll be sure to let you know. In the meantime, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits.